Republicans to wake up. The Republican Party right now is not led by conservatives. There's a population out there that has to be told the truth. We have to. Do it live!
Now, from the left coast, it's another podcast edition of the Peter B. Collins Show. Peter B. is curious, opinionated, and relentless in pursuit of the truth like a honeybee drawn to pollen. He's an independent progressive, ready to sting Republicans and Democrats alike when they deserve it. After years in commercial radio, Peter B. welcomes you to this audio adventure in news and politics with no corporate filter. Listeners support this program, and you can help at peterbcollins.com. Here's your humble host, Peter B.
Your humble host is grateful to the listeners who support this program voluntarily, like Teresa Paris, Annuel Rinaldi, Marilyn Ryan, and Rita Sheldrake. They're all voluntary subscribers. You can do it, too, if you're financially able and so inclined. Go to peterbcollins.com on the right-hand side of the homepage are the links where you can sign up for a PayPal subscription as little as $5 a month. You're about to hear an emotional conversation with journalist Jason Leopold about his interviews with former Guantanamo detainee David Hicks, the Australian. And toward the end of this podcast, Will Durst will weigh in with a satiric commentary about President Obama's budget. It's the Peter B. Collins Show. In a moment, Jason Leopold returns to our program. The U.S. government is claiming another vindication, another conviction in the so-called global war on terror. Another Guantanamo detainee has pled guilty in a plea bargain, hoping to find some way out of the no charge, no future detention that continues under President Obama. Jason Leopold is deputy managing editor at truthout.org, a frequent contributor to our program. And he and his colleague Jeffrey Kay have written about some issues related to Guantanamo, including the way medical professionals, psychiatrists, medical doctors, and psychologists were used by our military in experimentation to find out just the right way to waterboard somebody. And he's written an exclusive piece that is just out at truthout.org that is in some ways deeply personal. Jason, welcome back to our program.
Hey, Peter. Thanks so much for having me back on the show.
As you write in this story, you really had a hard time after you conducted telephone interviews with Australian David Hicks. He was the second person detained at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, back in January of 2002, the unlucky number 002 at Gitmo. Before we get into Hicks' story, talk a little bit about how it affected you, because it's pretty deep, isn't it?
It is, and, you know, just thinking about it sort of, it chokes me up, because I've never spoken to a Guantanamo detainee before. You know, Peter, I have these vivid memories of my grandparents, who were Holocaust survivors, early on telling me about the atrocities that they witnessed, the things that they went through, and that's something that always stuck in my mind. And just the, you know, the whole idea of these, for lack of a better word, injustices is, you know, has driven me throughout my life.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not making any comparison in terms of, Holocaust and this. I'm just trying to explain how, you know, how that's something that has always been in the back of my mind. So,
well, this is a reminder of you know, ancient and deeply felt family history.
Yes, and so, you know, that's what I sort of reached back to, or what what happened when I spoke to David, is that, first of all, let me just say that I didn't expect to have any sort of, you know, to feel that emotional, to be that impacted by what he was telling me. And as I said, I've never spoken to a Guantanamo detainee before, and getting him on the phone and speaking to him was in itself surreal, because, you know, he had just been a name on a charge sheet, a name in a news story, and to actually hear that voice, you know, he became a, you know, he was a human being, you know, mm-hmm. was a real person. And, you know, we spent several weeks speaking, exchanging emails, and very lengthy phone conversations, and he told me his story, told me what happened, certainly in a, you know, in his life, and also at Guantanamo. And I just found myself so moved, so paralyzed afterwards, after speaking with him, that I felt like it affected my ability to write. I was actually unable to really, you know, get started on the story, and unclear why. I mean, I had many sleepless nights, and yeah, I would just think about the fact that, you know, here's this guy, certainly on the phone sounds, you know, when I say innocent in the sense that, you know, he's helpless, he's in a prison facility, he's being tortured, and you know, I thought about that a lot, and when I finally decided to sit down and write this story, because I felt that I obviously had to, I was trying to figure out what to say, and I couldn't find the words. I could not come up with the, you know, the words of you know, what I wanted to say. So I really had to dig deep. And
let me let me ask, Jason, because I'm looking at your final draft. How many were there before the final?
How many words?
No. How many drafts did you have before you settled on the final one?
You know, that's a great question. I had probably about three or four, and each one was trying to tell it as a straight news story, and just it felt like toward the end, you know, toward that last draft that I scrapped, that it was just another story, Peter, about a guy who was tortured at Guantanamo, who had a story to tell, and I've written so many of those stories over the years. And, you know, in a way, it just felt like the same story, but more than that, it just felt like, what's going to happen if I write another one of those stories? What will the reaction be? People will be outraged, they'll move on. Right? No one will be held accountable. Nobody will think about it that much, and that's it. But you know, even as I wrote those drafts, I should say that they weren't complete, because I only was able to get through, you know, I don't know, about 10 paragraphs. So they weren't full drafts. And finally, you know, it was when I sat down and you know, to really think about what I wanted to say, why I was having such a hard time in writing the story, why I felt so paralyzed and at a loss for words, and I realized that I truly empathized with David Hicks. You know, the torture, what he recounted certainly affected me emotionally, but his story as to how he wound up in Afghanistan at training camps, how this guy, he's 5'3", okay, he I think he weighs like 125 pounds. It's a little guy who was a drifter, dropped out of school, you know, abused drugs and alcohol, converted to Islam, trying to belong to something. You know, how that happened, and I realized that I not only empathized with him, I understood. I understood how he could make such a bad choice. And I understood that because of my own story, my own past.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, as I say in this in this piece that I wrote, I too, you know, made some really bad choices in my life. And you know, one of which was ingratiating myself with a couple of main members of a New York crime family, you know, which I recounted in my own memoir, and which I paid a heavy price for.
Mm-hmm.
So it was. It was at that point that I realized that, you know, there were two things happening. One, I was, you know, moved by what happened to him and affected by it, and it was sticking in my head, and it upset me so much to know that, you know, that this happened to another human being.
Mm-hmm.
And I wanted to speak compassionately about it, and I wanted to humanize him, and I wanted to let people know how it made me feel. And
well, Jason, I want to thank you for doing that because, you know, you're a prolific writer. You have a great facility. I've never actually sat and watched you work, but I don't imagine when you're writing the latest story about BP that it dredges up any of these internal feelings or that you have any sense of identification with the subjects you're writing about.
No, in fact, I don't. And, you know, it certainly felt strange as I, you know, to have that sort of feeling that felt so so connected or you know to this person. So when I say connected, just feeling that so much compassion.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, BP is it's a company, and I'm able to sort of approach that as a news story. This was really disturbing. And
Jason, part of the story you tell about your feelings here is something that really connected with me. I have now spoken, I think, to 4 or 5 former Guantanamo prisoners. And in each case, I have to say that it's very different from almost any other kind of interview that I've done. And like you did with David Hicks, I often feel compelled to apologize on behalf of my country and my fellow citizens who are outraged by the great moral breaches of our torture and incarceration programs in the name of keeping Americans safe and secure. And I have gotten the same kind of reaction. You quote here, you say that you said to Hicks, "I'm sorry my government tortured you, David." And he said, "Thanks, mate," his voice cracking. Well, most of the former prisoners that I've talked to surprise me when I make an apology. They do accept the apology, no question or hesitation about that, but they are quick to forgive. And they will often try to assuage my feelings, and they go out of their way to not defend, but to undemonize, if you will,
yeah,
the people who actually executed the torture processes on them. And I find that remarkable because I cannot think that if I were in the same position, held indefinitely without charge under gruesome conditions, knowing that torture could resume at any moment, I just don't think that I could be so generous.
Yeah, that's you know, I didn't get into it in the in this very lengthy, you know, story that I wrote, but that's funny that you mentioned that because that was my feeling, and I was actually putting myself in his shoes. You know, I was trying to envision myself, you know. Being freed from this, you know, prison facility, indefinite detention, you know, you're there for 5 years, and what my reaction would be. And you know, and I guess in my mind, I was thinking that I personally would, you know, would be outraged, would want to, you know, I would be angry. And he was, you know, his reaction did surprise me.
Mm-hmm.
Because that was something I did not expect. And in terms of apologizing to him, I have to say that, you know, it just came out when I said that. I didn't know what else to say.
Yeah.
I really did not know what else to say. And, you know, I have to say, as a journalist, you know, I was torn because, you know, I was taught that, you know, you're a journalist, you're not supposed to get, you know, close to, you know, people, interview subjects. You're not supposed to really be affected. And, you know, I'm a human being. Here's another human being talking about, you know, his experience. And it was chilling. And, you know, I just, I really felt that, you know, in order to truly tell this story and make people understand of, you know, what our government did, what they continue to do, I wanted to let them in, if, mm-hmm. you know. And that was a hard decision because, you know, I didn't want to feel so vulnerable. And I certainly did. And at the same time, I didn't want to take away from David's story. I felt that was the only way, Peter, that I would be able to, you know, to complete the entire story in and of itself is to just give people a different perspective.
And let me jump off from there and quote from your story. This is in your voice. So I've made the decision that I would expose my own vulnerability and tell you how my interview with the man dubbed Australian Taliban has weighed heavily on my mind. I still cannot comprehend what could drive a human being to torture another human being. Hicks said at Guantanamo, quote, torture was driven by anger and frustration. And he goes on. It seemed like a mad, fruitless quest to pin crimes on detainees, to extract false confessions, and produce so-called intelligence of value. The guards were desensitized, and detainees dehumanized. Soldiers were not allowed to engage us in conversation. They were told to address us by number only and not by name. They were constantly drilled with propaganda about how much we supposedly hated them and wanted them dead, and how much they needed to hate us. On occasion, when some groups of soldiers jogged around the camp perimeters, I heard them sing lyrics such as, "You hate us, and we hate you." One time in the privacy of Camp Echo, a male soldier broke down when we were alone, repeating, "What have I become?" after having arrived from an interrogation of a detainee in another camp. Wow.
Yeah, it's, you know, speaking to him, and as I said, you know, my past experience in covering the story, Peter, and certainly trying the best I could to humanize these people and to give them a voice has really come from documents, maybe some of the combatant status, you know, review, tribunal, transcripts. But being on the phone with him and listening to him, you know, explain this in his own voice, you know, it was real, and it was, and I believed him. And, you know, I think that some people are very quick to say, well, we can't believe him. It's a lie. This guy, David Hicks, was genuine. And, you know, he was being real. And then, you know, another real important part of the story is the two Guantanamo guards.
Yes.
Who I spoke with.
And let me yeah. just say, from a point of view of news and journalism, this was brilliantly written, because you move from the quote that I just read from David Hicks to a brief profile of Brandon Neely, a former military policeman at Guantanamo, who was actually the guy who escorted David Hicks off the bus when he arrived there on the day that the camp opened.
Yeah, yeah. You know, what an incredibly brave and courageous guy Brandon Neely is. You know, he, a couple of years ago, actually, I'm sorry, it was last year, Brandon traveled to London to meet two detainees that that he was guarding, actually, at Guantanamo, to apologize. And, you know, something that was, you know, captured by the BBC in a very short, you know, little film. But, you know, he spoke to David Hicks. He, you know, took him off the plane. And you know, as Brandon said to me, you know, one of the first things that they said was, this guy was, he tried to bite through the hydraulic lines on the C-130 that was transporting him to Guantanamo. That's actually what the, you know, commanders said at Guantanamo as they were getting ready to take him off the plane. And it was, they weren't kidding. They actually said that, we want you to know how dangerous this guy David Hicks is. This is what he just did. We just got word of it.
And Jason, can I just jump in here to call bullshit? Because
we
know that the way these people were transported on these planes was a very brutal protocol that was used on every last one of them. They were essentially in straitjackets. They were diapered. They were given a suppository up the butt. We don't really know what that was, but it could have been a sedative. It could have been something to kind of lock down their gastric system for the, you know, the length of the journey. But these people were so carefully hogtied, blindfolded, gagged, and secured that the idea that any one of them could have gotten close to hydraulic cables and started to chew on them is just totally bogus.
Yeah, it's unbelievable, and it also underscores the the extent to which the, you know, government lied to, you know, the soldiers, to people who volunteered, you know, to get involved, to, you know, in the name of freedom or whatever.
Well, and this was part of a conscious plan that was used at Guantanamo called Fear Up.
Yeah.
And this idea of fearing people up was one of the practices in the so-called enhanced interrogation techniques. And so from day one, from the moment of arrival, we can see that the commanders were creating an atmosphere of fear of the detainees, and they wanted to fire up the soldiers so that they would be as brutal as possible and treat these people as hardcore enemies.
Exactly.
And it's not only illegal and immoral, but it's counterproductive, because we know that if you really want to get information out of people, brutalizing them and putting them into a posture of fear and dependency won't produce anything positive.
Exactly. I mean, it's all true. And you know, what Brandon was saying is they would constantly drill into their heads that, you know, everyone was responsible for 9/11. And he believed it. I mean, this was, you know, Brandon is, I think it was, you know, he was 21 when he was sent down to Guantanamo. And, you know, really young guy and has no idea what a terrorist looked like. You know, he's being told that all of these guys, including David Hicks, are, you know, they're responsible for 9/11. They'll kill you and your families in a heartbeat. And he believed it. And, you know, Brandon was pretty torn up about this. You know, spent many years after he returned, after, you know, he went to Iraq after Guantanamo, realizing, you know, he came to a realization he was lied to, and it affected him, and it also affected Albert Molise, one of the most, you know, I mean, the guy deserves his own sort of separate story, mm-hmm. because what he did to try and restore humanity for a few months at that camp where David Hicks was held, at Camp Echo, is extraordinary, and he risked going to jail in order to give them just a small dose of feeling, you know, of humanity, of just, you know, feeling that trying to relieve their suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Albert is a guy who worked in Massachusetts. He was a Massachusetts housing cop, sent to Guantanamo, certainly did not want to be there, but he went. You know, his reserve unit was activated, and he worked at, you know, Camp Delta and assisted, you know, escorting the detainees to interrogation. And, you know, this is someone who has carried around a lot of weight on his shoulders for many years. The first time he's, you know, speaking publicly about it, and it's truly stunning. And so together, all of these people, you know, all three of them, and me, you know, making it four, were affected.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and I have to say, Peter, that I didn't really think about how, you know, torture affected, you know, some of the soldiers. I mean, as I said in the story, for Brandon, it was as if he was being tortured every day, from what he witnessed. You know, for Albert, you know, the same thing. You know, I asked Albert about, you know, what he saw in those interrogation rooms. And he said, please don't ask me about that. You know, I still have nightmares. I've seen these people cry. And, you know, I felt like that sort of said it all. You know, what more? You know, he could certainly go into detail, but I felt like right there I understood. And, you know, he wanted to redeem himself. He started drinking himself, and just to numb what he was feeling. And he said to me, "I'm a good soul, and I was put in a horrible place." And I mean, what those words really made an impact on me. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, he went to Camp Echo, was transferred there. You know, begged for a transfer. And said he was going to redeem himself, and you know what he did was is that at least with David, tried to make him feel like he was back home in Australia by taking in a handheld DVD player and showing him some movies. One was Mad Max, you know, starring Mel Gibson. You know, he felt like okay, he'll hear Mel Gibson's accent and feel like he's back home or something. So, I mean. You know, he actually thought about that. The guy, you know, he put thought into it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he shared his food. He let them walk around. You know, just these, whatever he could do. And I was blown away by, you know, by that, and as well. And you know, it really made an impression, and made me feel like, you know what, there must be other, you know, guards, Guantanamo guards out there that, you know, were doing these things and are, you know, torn up about it. And, you know, Brandon and Albert both told me, like, yeah, there are. Unfortunately, the government made them sign, all of them, a piece of paper that says you cannot speak to the media, you can't write a book, you can't make a movie about any of this. And many of those guards, many of those people who served in, you know, Guantanamo are actually scared to come forward because they, you know, they believe that they'll either be, you know, prosecuted or what have you. And,
mm-hmm.
You know, for Brandon and Albert, they decided to, you know, defy that, those orders and speak up. And you know, for Brandon, who did that about a year and a half ago, actually, I'm sorry, about 2 years ago, the first time when he gave, you know, some testimony to UC Davis's Center for Human Rights Studies, you know, he was fine. Nothing happened to him. So it's, you know, what's interesting is that they both now speak to David Hicks regularly. They, you know, they've since befriended him, as well as... you know, a couple of other, you know, former detainees, British detainees who have, who have since been released.
And what's interesting is that Skype is the connectivity method of choice
right.
of the former Gitmo posse, both the guards and the former inmates there.
Yeah.
Jason, let's take a moment here to detail David Hicks' story. You've had the opportunity to read his memoir called Guantanamo, My Journey, which is not available in the United States, and I infer that that's part of the release orders or agreement that he signed.
Yeah.
But let's start off with why was he in Afghanistan, and how did he get sold into Bounty and end up in U.S. custody?
Well, he was, back in, as I said, he dropped out of high school, was a drifter. He had a good relationship with his family. He was just, looking for something bigger, wanted to belong to something. So he moved around a lot. When he was in Japan as a horse trainer, I think it was in 1999, he was watching the news and saw what was happening in Bosnia and decided to, sign up for the Kosovo Liberation Army. And, he signed up to, fight on the side of, NATO, U.S. He never, got involved in any combat. In fact, everything was over at that point. And he returned back to Australia, trying to, find his place. Just started reading various different books, literature, learning about, religions, and, fell into Islam. And not any sort of radical, form of Islam, just, went to a mosque in Australia, and observed and said, hey, this is a place maybe I could, belong to. So, as he says, he felt that he was very impressionable, full of bravado. He uses that word bravado, and naive. And, from, at that point, he then traveled to Pakistan and, became involved with, a more, fundamentalist form of Islam, much more strict, and was involved with some groups that would later, years later, the U.S. would call them terrorist organizations. And still, by the way, I have to say, this is not being an apologist of any sort. It's just it's not a group that did anything. It's just the, what they were practicing. And allegations that they were supporting, Al-Qaeda. So, he spent time there, and at that point, this was, I believe, in about 2000, late 2000, he then, traveled to Afghanistan and went to training camps in early 2001. And their training camps that the that the government says was linked to Al-Qaeda training camps, and he one of these camps was visited by Osama bin Laden. This was before 9/11, and at that point he he was taking part in various sort of, I think it was weapons, targeting, things that just started getting very radical. And he was asked to do, to go on certain missions, and he declined. And so at this point he was starting to fall out, with these groups, because, as he says in his book, he was just looking to, you know, to explore the Silk Road is what he says, and he had no idea what this was all about, and in the way that he describes it, which he does much more eloquently than I'm doing, it's very believable. So what happened was he just got deeper into associating with jihadists, and after 9/11, he made just such a really bad choice here, Peter. He went to Pakistan and was going to fly home to Australia, but decided to go to Afghanistan. And this is where I'm not completely convinced of his reasoning, but decided to go back to Afghanistan because, he wanted to pick up some of his belongings, is what he says. Now, I know people have made really dumb decisions, and that was a dumb decision on his part because at that point he was, in Afghanistan. It was November, late October 2001. He was hiding out. He couldn't cross the border to get back into Pakistan to go back to Australia. Was hiding out in some safe houses. Finally, he was gets out of the the safe house was with a bunch of people to go to Pakistan so he can literally get to the airport to go back home to Australia, and was at a taxi stand. And at this taxi stand, he didn't speak Arabic, does not, and as I said, he's 5'3", and he's white. So he really stood out.
Mm-hmm.
And, at this taxi stand, he just got picked up by the Northern Alliance. And at that point, he was sold to, U.S. forces for about $1,500, which many detainees were, by the way, many innocent detainees, too. And
let me just interject, because you introduced me to Andy Worthington, who is the British journalist who has covered Guantanamo better than possibly anybody else. And he's profiled so many of the stories of those who've been held there. And time after time, we see that people who were in Afghanistan or at the AFPAC border area during this period of time were sold because they had offended the Northern Alliance or some of the other local warlords by promoting Western values, primarily schooling females.
Right.
And we see this over and over again, that people who really were just unpopular with locals all of a sudden found themselves in U.S. custody, and the locals who turned them in got some cold, hard American cash. Up to $7,500 is the amount that I've heard mentioned most frequently. So if Hicks was picked up for only $1,500, that's not even market rates.
Yes, it's not, and it was very early, and so at this point it's what did he do, right? What did he do? Okay, he was at a training camp. He was not fighting. He was not. Keep in mind, this is an Australian citizen, so he wasn't on the front lines. He just happened to be at the wrong place at the wrong time. And let me just say that I know that for some people will react to that saying, come on. And I do understand that. I do understand that, that reaction. I don't know what was in, David Hicks's mind. I really don't know. So I have to, go by what he wrote in his book and what he said to me. And I have to say that, I believe that this was a guy who was not only naive, but to some extent really, just brainwash, maybe, the way some people, they get involved in a cult.
Mm-hmm.
But he did make the decision to leave. Now, at that point he was, was picked up and taken to two naval ships, where he was, that's where his brutal interrogation started. He endured a beating, at one point for 10 hours. And it's really interesting, Peter, because I got my hands on a letter, unredacted, that he wrote at Guantanamo, which he had given to Albert Meliz, one of the guards. And Albert said that he would, smuggle it out and mail it to his father, because, what David was unable to do was really describe what was happening to him, because if he mentioned any abuse, they would redact it. It was, his father would never know about it. So, in this letter, he talks about just to show how they not only psychologically broke down, these detainees, but just the level of torture that they endured, was so bad that David actually referred to the beatings as just mild beatings, as if that's, in the way that he wrote it as was trying to say that, what he endured was not as bad as what other people had endured.
And let me lift a quote from your article from David Hicks here, quote, "Usually the guard seemed cold and indifferent. They deployed a just doing my job attitude, such as when they chained me to the floor in stress positions, or made me sleep directly on a metal or concrete floor in a very cold air-conditioned room in only a pair of shorts. However, some soldiers displayed discomfort and embarrassment. Usually, guards were only used to restrain detainees, move them about, or help in the background with equipment. It was the interrogators who did the dirty work, expressing hatred and frustration. At times, soldiers did participate directly in beatings, however, such as the beatings I received before I arrived in Gitmo, in Afghanistan, in transit, when I was rendered to two naval ships before being sent to Guantanamo. These soldiers made a sport of it. I was beaten by U.S. forces the first time I saw them and realized straight away that torture was going to be a reality. It was very scary. As I say in my book, I could not help thinking of the saying, like trying to get blood from a stone, and I was afraid of becoming that stone."
Yeah. Yeah, it's, pretty moving stuff. And, just getting back to, the choices that he made, they were truly, bad choices. To go back to what I said at the beginning of our conversation, Peter, I understand. I got to tell you that, and I know that, we've talked about my book before, but I have a vivid memory of being in New York City, which is where, I grew up, and being fascinated with the mafia. I was a young guy. I was, in my 20s, and I romanticized, glamorized it, but also felt like, hey, this is a family. Got involved, got involved, with, just made a terrible decision. I mean, I look back on that, it was 20 years ago, almost, and I look back on it and, how did that happen? I didn't kill anybody, and I certainly did not suffer like David did, but my point in saying this is that, I empathize and I understand, how people get lost. And
if we use GWAT rules against you, we'd say that you provided material support to mafia members.
Right.
And we could lock you up for that.
Right. And you know what? Totally could say that. And it's, it gives me a chill just to think about that. At the same time, let's just say that when it came time for David Hicks's trial to bring him up on charges, Peter, they didn't have any evidence really that that he broke any laws at the time.
Now wait a minute. He was at Guantanamo, therefore he's guilty.
Right. Well, there you go.
He's one of the worst of the worst.
He's one of the worst.
Dick Cheney told us.
Yeah.
That's all we need.
That's, it's very interesting that. How many people truly were there that were, that were innocent, and how the, the worst of the worst line is something that, Rumsfeld continues to say with the release of his own book.
Well, based on Andy Worthington's work, at least 600 of the 775 who were ultimately held at Guantanamo were released without charge, presumed to be innocent.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, it's amazing because when it came time to bring him up on, okay, let's charge him, they came up with a list of charges that were just outrageous. I mean, they accused him of trying to kill Americans, fighting on the front lines. I mean, things that he did not do. He it's been established since almost a decade now that the early charges that were filed against him were just absolutely untrue, made up out of whole cloth. Finally, they realized we don't have anything on him that we can bring him up on, and it was in the 2006 Military Commissions Act, this is where they first made material support for terrorism a war crime.
Mm-hmm.
Now under international law, Australian law, he didn't break any laws. He just happened to be at a training camp, and they did not want to release him to Australia because Australia would not be able to do anything. They would basically, the Howard guy, Prime Minister John Howard at the time, they would have to let him go. So the Bush administration certainly didn't want to do that, so they just continued to hold him. And finally, after being in Guantanamo for 5.5 years, and the Howard administration in Australia, under pressure to do something about their two citizens that they had at Guantanamo at the time, to do something about at least David, who was one of the last, they basically cut a deal with him. Said, okay, look, we'll let you out of here from Guantanamo, but here's the deal: you need to plead guilty to this charge of providing material support for terrorism. You go to Australia, serve 9 months of a suspended 5-year prison term, 5 or 7 years, I believe, in Australia, and then you're free. And it turns out now that the real behind the scenes activity that was going on, it turns out, is that Dick Cheney, and this is documented, Dick Cheney had a conversation with Prime Minister John Howard in February of 2007, a month before David Hicks was, formally pled guilty to that charge.
Mm-hmm.
And John Howard said, look, I'm facing re-election, tough re-election battle here. I need you, this David Hicks issue is turning out to be a political threat to me. Something needs to happen. And a month before that, by the way, the ambassador to Australia had met with government officials, and William Haynes, one of the architects and of the DOD side of the torture program.
Right, he was the legal counsel at the Department of Defense, and he now holds the position as a legal counsel at Chevron Corporation.
That's right. Yeah, and he had phoned the one of the prosecutors, chief prosecutors at the Guantanamo, saying, how quickly can you charge David Hicks? So favors were starting to be called in. How quickly can you charge him? And, this Colonel Morris Davis said he felt pressured. He ended up resigning in protest. So you had this, the whole thing was just a farce. First of all, the military commissions were designed just to get guilty pleas. But here you have somebody who is turning out to be a political threat, to the re-election, Prime Minister John Howard. So they made a deal with him. And after 5.5 years there, this was his best chance of being released.
Mm-hmm.
He pled guilty. The letter that I have from Albert, it's a 6-page letter. It makes it abundantly clear, Peter, that, because he was writing to his father, that, you know, he was coerced, pressured, tortured, coerced, pressured to sign a, you know, a statement saying, I, you know, did these things that the government was alleging, and, you know, just talking about his, you know, the torture. And, you know, the letter says that, you know, one of the things that he says is that this letter is very important. Again, dear Dad, this was in April 2004, dear Dad, this letter is very important because it's the first and probably only time I will be able to tell you the truth of my situation. And, you know, I think that it really sort of underscores the plight of certainly many of the remaining, you know, prisoners there, but probably, you know, you know, the ones that, you know, that were held there very early on. And, you know, when it comes down to it, you know, we don't spend enough time vilifying, in my opinion at least, you know, government officials who, you know, committed serious, you know, judicial abuses, you know, abuse their positions of power. You know, here it's just amazing that here they are, you know, accusing many of these people of serious crimes. I mean, you know, we're talking about you know, crimes that would that would send them away, you know, for life. And that's not to say that there are, you know, there's some people that, you know, really bad individuals who should just be prosecuted, which they're just not doing. But, you know, for somebody like David Hicks, they were accusing him of things that he didn't do, and at the same time, you know, abusing the, you know, their positions of power in order to, you know, get him to, you know, make these admissions, you know, for self-serving reasons.
Well, and it's clear that it was the political pressure from David Hicks' father, the risk that that presented to John Howard's reelection, and you point out in the article that he ultimately didn't win reelection at any rate.
Right.
But it was the political byplay between the Howard government and the office of Dick Cheney that really drove the offer of a plea deal. And you also indicate that Susan Crawford, who was the convening authority over military commissions, was very tight with Cheney. She had been appointed as his special advisor. She had been a Pentagon inspector general and then a judge on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, all under the jurisdiction of Dick Cheney.
Right, right. And you know, let me just say this, Peter. I did not reveal this in my story, but I know that there's documents out there, and I expect to receive some of these documents in a short amount of time. That will further expose what went on behind the scenes with David Hicks. Mm. And you know, as you noted, when we you know, first started our conversation here, that you know, he was one of the first at Guantanamo, and his case happens to be, you know, people may forget, but he happens to be one of the small group, you know, part of the small group of detainees who challenged, you know, Bush's executive authority to, you know, hold detainees indefinitely, which led to the landmark, you know, Supreme Court case,
right,
you know, striking that down. So he's, you know, he was a very, very important figure for the Bush administration early on to, you know, in their efforts to, you know, get the military commissions, you know, off the ground, and to show that they could, you know, obtain guilty pleas.
Mm-hmm.
These documents will, and I've spoken to several people who are familiar with them, will show what went on behind the scenes, the conversations that took place with the Office of the Vice President and the administration of Prime Minister John Howard, and, you know, how this was all worked out, and it will be really disturbing. And, you know, as I said, he was one of the first charged under, you know, the Military Commissions Act, and the first, you know, the first guilty plea, you know, that they obtained. To date, we only have, you know, as far as the one that was the most recent guilty plea, we only have six, you know, that they've been able to obtain thus far, largely because this is just, you know, such a flawed process.
Well, and it's quite easy to see that if you are being held indefinitely without charge, and they give you an opportunity to get out, even with onerous terms, even with a requirement that you plead guilty to things that you had no connection to, one would do that. I mean, I have no criticism of David Hicks for cutting the deal that ultimately won his return to Australia and now his freedom. But, you know, it's easy to see how much leverage the captors have. And when they control the entire incarceration and kangaroo court processes, then you have no choice but to dance with the kangaroos.
Right. Well, you know, as I noted in the story in this letter, this letter that was written in 2004, you know, he said, if I make any deal, you know, Dad, if I wind up making any deal, just know I'm doing it against my will. No, I'm doing it because I can't be here anymore.
Yeah,
I want to get out.
Mm-hmm.
You know, let me just say this, Peter. That's another thing I can understand. I myself, you know, was, you know, facing, as a result of my indiscretions, a very lengthy prison sentence, and I made a deal. So that wouldn't happen.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a different, entirely different, you know, issue. And I certainly, you know, am guilty of the, you know, the crime that I did plead guilty to. But I understand what that, you know, what that is.
Yeah.
You know, so,
mm-hmm.
You know, part of the whole seeing him for me, you know, as a human being. And realizing that, you know, that he's a person. You know, he did not deserve, you know, to be treated this way.
Let me quote a little more from the letter that Hicks wrote to his father, but was not delivered until you faxed it to him. Quote, before I start, I want you to know the negative things I'm going to say has nothing to do with the MPs that are watching me. Some of them are marvelous people who have taken risks to help improve my day-to-day living. It's because of such people that I've kept my sanity and still have some strength left. In the early days before I made it to Cuba, I received some harsh treatment and transportation, including mild beatings, about four. One lasted for 10 hours.
Imagine describing a 10-hour beating as mild.
Yeah.
You know?
That is priceless. He goes on, I've always cooperated with interrogators. For 2 years, they had control of my life in the camps. If you talk and just agree with what they're saying, they give you real food, books, and other special privileges. If not, they can make your life hell.
Yeah.
He says, know that if I make a deal, it will be against my will. I just couldn't handle it any longer. I'm disappointed in our government. I'm an Australian citizen. If I've committed a crime, I can be man enough to accept the consequences. But I shouldn't have to admit to things that I haven't done or listen to people falsely accuse me. We can't let them get away with that. So what is his status now, and is he completely free?
He is completely free. You know, I should say this, you know, he published his book last October and has been vilified, basically, for, you know, saying, hey, I was tortured. You know, accused of being a liar, and this is by the, you know, Australian media, that, you know, felt as if, he got what he deserved. So there were efforts, or at least discussions, that he would be, you know, charged, or they would try to take away the proceeds, you know, from his book. Under, you know, some sort of law that they have there that's kind of similar to the Son of Sam law, here, but it has, you know, obviously it didn't murder anybody, but they would try to, you know, go after him. And also for, you know, when he left Guantanamo, he had, you know, one of the conditions was he had to sign a statement that said he would, you know, he agreed, or the where he would, he said that he was not illegally treated while in U.S. custody, and that he would not file any lawsuits or, you know, make these claims. Nothing has happened, and I think you know, nobody tried to go after him, and in fact, if they did, I think it would only serve to backfire on, you know, that government. But David married a, interestingly, you know, he married a human rights activist a couple of years ago, who was involved in his, you know, in the effort to, you know, free him, and he's working, and just, you know, he does some landscaping work, and he's trying to recover. He's, you know, it's a very difficult, you know, process. And, you know, one of the things that he said was is that he was being criticized because he would not do any, you know, media interviews with, you know, major media. And you know, the media was upset about that. And he was saying, I said, look, you know, I spent 5 years in Guantanamo. I've got, I get this reaction as if I'm back in Guantanamo, you know, when I'm sitting in front of a, you know, a camera with lights. And, you know, it was difficult for him. Do that, you know. He tried to explain why he was, you know, turning it down. And at the same time, you know, they were, you know, he felt that he was not getting given a fair shot. But I was really pleased that, you know, he agreed to speak with me, and you know, felt that my work has, you know, sort of served to, you know, cast a spotlight, if you will, on, you know, these past abuses and crimes, and you know, I have to say, I'm really glad I wrote the story, and I am really, you know, happy I wrote it the way I did, because you know, speaking to David and just looking at this, it's changed me in many different ways, and it's also made me feel that I need to, you know, continue to report this and document, at least for the, you know, historical public record, you know, what happened.
Well, Jason, I'm very grateful that you wrote it and that you wrote it the way you did. I know that, like you, I wrestle at times with injecting myself too much into a story. But I think that this was quite appropriate, and it enhanced David Hicks' story. So I really do appreciate it on so many levels.
Thank you, Peter. I appreciate that very much.
And just briefly, because I haven't talked about Guantanamo too much recently, I wanted to update our listeners that the two men who were released from Guantanamo and resettled to separate European countries are still there. And the one who I referred to who has serious health issues, those remain inadequately addressed. And the last time I heard from him, my efforts to get the United States ambassador in that country to contact this gentleman and try to assist him with the ongoing needs that he faces produced silence. No response whatsoever through a back channel that I used to try to reach the U.S. ambassador in that country. So while those two men were resettled, are no longer trapped at Guantanamo, they are in a prison of a different nature, created by our government, and it appears they may live their lives out in these kind of virtual cells that they have been consigned to. Not a happy ending, but if there is any further update, I'll be certain to pass it along to you. Jason Leopold, Deputy Managing Editor, truthout.org, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Peter.
And now, San Francisco comedian and satirist Will Durst shares his rants about Barack Obama's latest budget proposal.
Hey, guys. Will Durst here with your budget update for this hour. And if I were you, I'd find a nice comfy chair to sink into, because this is more confusing than translating Sanskrit into Japanese using Morse code. President Obama released his budget plan for the next 2 years, and it calls for tens of billions of dollars worth of cuts to non-entitlement programs. The Republicans countered with a plan for this year's budget that includes $100 billion worth of cuts, and Ron Paul, well, he just wants to invade China, give them a proper thrashing, and take all our money back. So yeah, it looks like business as usual. Needless to say, people are taking to each other's plan like a pot of giant squid take to hot air ballooning. Obama compares the GOP strategy to a dieter who promises to lose 30 pounds, then does it by cutting off one leg. He says their plan will undermine government functions, nip a blooming recovery in the bud, and force 14-year-old suburban girls into the streets to sell apples to earn money for Justin Bieber tickets. The GOP responded by characterizing the president as a girly man afraid of making tough decisions who could probably provide better leadership by curling into a fetal position behind the couch, licking the cat's butt. Congress has to pass a spending bill before March 4th, or the entire government shuts down, which wouldn't be so bad if it weren't for the whole roads and hospitals and air traffic controllers thing. The one deal everybody does agree on is that the new fiscal reality is going to affect everything. Education, security, and agriculture, meeting more students per class, fewer cops on the streets, and larger pieces of pig hoof in your wiener. But while they bristle and posture in public like porcupines in heat, Obama remains confident he can find common ground with the GOP leadership in private, which, considering the intransigence on both sides, may be the political equivalent of planning to escape a burning building by tying together the sleeves of a vest. For the Peter B. Collins Show, I'm Will Durst.
Thanks for listening to the Peter B. Collins Show. Share it with a friend, will you? And email your comments to peter@peterbcollins.com.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you.